My name is Liam McBain, and I am interviewing Elizabeth Shaw for the Oral History Summer School Education Narratives Project. Elizabeth is, actually, I don't know where you are. Would you mind like introducing yourself and saying where you are?
Sure, I'm Elizabeth Shaw. I am in a studio apartment at 86th and Central Park West. Just a few blocks away from where I work at 79th and Amsterdam. Okay. In Manhattan, New York, Lenape Hocking.
Okay, great. And just like a little introduction about yourself, who you are, like.
I'm 35, I'm a cis white bi woman, I'm Jewish from an interfaith home, and I am a teacher, which is why I'm participating in this project. I'm a library teacher to students at a Jewish day school in the first, second, third, and fourth grades. And I also teach at a religious school for Reform Judaism I teach kindergarten through sixth grade. And I think that's basically what I teach right now.
To start, I would like to know a little bit more about like what your teaching setup looks like. So like physically the space that you are in when you teach and like what you have around you and all that.
Sure. We've been back in person. So the majority of my teaching happens in the school building at 79th in Amsterdam. And it has been happening both in the classrooms, in outdoor learning spaces, and in the library itself, which I am sharing with a Jewish studies teacher and the third grade learning center teacher, who is also my sister. And so it's a mixed use space, and typically the way that I've taught has changed several times over the past 11 weeks. Right now I'm usually in the library, or I'll start off in the classroom for the first 10 minutes or so and then go to the library. The library is the size, it's two classrooms joined together. It has windows that can be opened, so there's pretty good airflow. And, you know, the library is designed to serve just first through fourth grades, so there's a section that is more appropriate for younger kids and one that is a little bit more sort of academic or scholarly looking, which the older kids and the teachers use more. And the teachers who share the room, me, Damara, the Jewish studies teacher, and my sister Rachel, are almost spread pretty much equidistantly over the classroom from wall to wall. So we have a good amount of space between us. We have a smart board in the library that we use. The classrooms have smart boards, and the children this year each have their own laptops. So they are one-to-one with MacBook Airs, which are definitely nicer than my computer. And so sometimes I am also teaching distance learners at the same time. So my teaching setup then will be either sort of with an OWL camera, which is other people have probably described them, but they are little cylinders that that have like audio and video inputs and outputs and are connected to the smart board. So if somebody is at home because they're in quarantine or because they're learning remotely, then they will be basically, I'm teaching to the OWL camera and to the classroom. And then if I'm teaching a full class of remote learners, then I'll be in a Zoom meeting. And in that case, I might be in the library, in the stairway. You know, I might come home and teach from here, or I've been moving around during COVID times, so I might be in my short-term rental up in Inwood, or I might be with my sister in Brooklyn. So my teaching environment has been varied, I would say.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of moving parts. Yeah, so you talked a little bit about like changes in the way you've taught in the last like 11 weeks, you said. So I'm just kind of wondering like what those changes look like for you.
When we started, we were really trying to keep students out of space, that we were really trying to keep students in their own spaces. And so there was not really a question of them coming to the library. But I also, due to health conditions, I was not comfortable being in the classrooms for long stretches of time, basically, because I didn't feel confident in students' mask wearing. I didn't know anything about the ventilation. I also didn't think that I would be able to be as physically distanced as was recommended from students just in the course of my teaching. So the accommodation that I worked out with the administration was that I would have a teaching assistant, and he would go into, like, basically I would go into the classroom for the first 10 or 15 minutes. I would teach a short lesson, and then I would sort of return to the, like, I would get requests from the students, and I would return to the library, kind of like select different books and come down to the, and come down to the classroom. And then in practice, that was really cumbersome and not that easy to do. And also I saw that mask compliance was relatively good. What we started doing was sort of a flip where I would come down for the first 15, 20 minutes, do a lesson, and then I would take half the kids up to browse the library. And then Jacob, my teaching assistant, would stay downstairs with the other half and do an activity or another read aloud with them. And then I would come down and get the second half. And so they would get a little bit of browsing time. Everybody would be in motion a little bit, and they would get the benefit of the library space. So that worked for a little while, and we did that for a little while. And then the reason that was sort of more possible then was at the beginning of the year, students are still being kind of assessed, and the dynamics of the different students with the teachers are still kind of playing out, and all of that. So they don't start pull out learning center, right, which is for students who need support with reading or math, need additional, like, specialized support. So that doesn't start until about 6 weeks into the school year. So when it started, the space was being used for 4 periods a day. And so I couldn't bring kids to the library during that time. So at that time, we changed it so that I would be in the classroom, or I would be teaching outdoors. That's when I started using an outdoor garden terrace space. I would be teaching outdoors for the students with whom I couldn't take to the classroom, or take to the library rather. So then I would be, like, in this tiny garden space with, like, a bunch of kids for a little while. During Sukkot, there was, like, a temporary structure that was, like, erected in the space that we were crawling in and over. So I was there for the kids who couldn't come to the library. I was doing the library thing for kids who could. And then I felt bad that was inequitable, so I arranged for there to be browsing time for the kids in the library at times when my sister wasn't using the space. So where we are now is that there are some kids who I teach outside, and they come to the library at a different time. And there are some kids who come to the library, and they installed window guards on the windows so we can open them now. So now that that's the case, I feel more comfortable having them in the library for a full 40-minute period. And it's just, like, it's so much easier. Because the kids are sitting in the classroom, the kids are sitting behind plexiglass barriers, and it's hard to hear, it's hard to get their attention, they're sitting there all day. So since the library is quite big, and because we have relatively good ventilation, I sort of had them up in the library preferentially. I'm trying to think if anything else has changed. Oh, I was asked to take on, for the first time in my life, I'm teaching a reading group, which is very funny because for some reason people think a librarian can automatically teach reading, which we cannot. But this is a reading group that's essentially just, like, enrichment for kids who are already, don't need any, they're in first grade and they don't need any of the decoding work that most of the first grade is doing. So we basically just read books together and have a good time. So that is an additional teaching responsibility. And that is one of the hybrid classes. That's two kids from two different classrooms and a kid who's at home, and none of them can be together, obviously. So it's a Zoom. This kid is, like, zooming in from two of them are zooming in from their classrooms, and, like, trying to learn while everybody else is doing a different lesson. So it's a bit chaotic, but they are really good sports about it. And then, yeah, that's those are some of the bigger changes that have occurred in my schedule. Overall in the school, one thing that changed is that we finally started doing asymptomatic surveillance testing this week. Like, this is the first week we're doing that. Previously, you would get a test upon the recommendation from the nurse. If she felt like your symptoms warranted it, and they decided to ramp it up, and so we had on-site testing, and we're waiting to get the results back. We had one outbreak. Maybe I should have led with that. We had an outbreak at the school, and that was so the decision to start surveillance testing, I think, was a result of that outbreak. And also a result to some degree of parent and teacher concern after the outbreak, because we returned to school quite quickly after it. We sort of found out about it on a Wednesday, closed down for 3 days, and then everybody was asked to return to the building on the Monday after that. And we had 5 cases, 4 students and a teacher. And it was just, that was very hard for many faculty to accept. And it was also, I assume there were parents who felt very challenged by it, because actually there were parents who kept their kids home for the next 2 weeks anyway. So I would say those are the parents who were concerned about it. But the through line has always been that, like, the parents have the option to keep their kids home, and in most cases the ability, and the teachers do not have the option to stay at home. So I think that it was largely due to faculty upset and faculty resistance that they decided to start doing this, which many other schools have been doing since the beginning, may I say. So that's kind of some of the things that have been happening.
I definitely want to know a little bit more about that outbreak and what that was like when you first heard about it, like how you felt about it, and of course, like, all of the stuff that ensued. Like, what was that like?
All right, so let me try to cast my memory back, because I'm sure you're hearing this from a bunch of people, but this pandemic brain fog is really a thing. And I guess the first thing that happened was we found out, this is all happening sort of in the scope of the Jewish year, so I need to kind of anchor it in time to where that was. So we were out for... I think it was Rosh Hashanah, and we had, I was up in, I was up in, I was, had, we were, had gone to my mother's, and we heard on Sunday that there was an isolated case in the 7th grade, and then, so that student's cohort was going to stay home. On Tuesday, I was a little sick, and I stayed home that whole week. I was sick. The nurse told me to stay home. And on Tuesday, I guess a teacher, well, on Sunday, also a teacher was symptomatic, stayed home. And then on Tuesday, one of the students in that teacher's class tested positive. And then sort of like I think there were 2 other students in that class. Like, the results were kind of coming in. And so on Wednesday, they sort of announced that they were going to take off, the school would be closed on Thursday and Friday. We worked those days. We were putting together, bins of supplies for parents to take home to students in the event that we were moving to distance learning, or that we would for 2 weeks or for longer. And I did come in on that Friday, because I needed to show some teachers where some things were. So I kind of like snuck out of the house and came in. And then it was Yom Kippur, and a lot of people were celebrate, not some, a lot of people were observing. I'm trying to get this right. I'm trying to remember if it was Yom Kippur or if it was Sukkot. There was some reason, there was some reason that people weren't checking their emails. And we got this crazy email at like, you know, like in the late afternoon that was like, by the way, we're reopening tomorrow. And people, like the faculty, like collectively lost their mind because it was, we were like, are you kidding me? Like we, like clearly whatever you were doing didn't work in the classroom. Like, you know, what is happening? Like they asked everybody to get tests. They asked the whole community to get tested on Wednesday. So they didn't have all the tests back, but they said they had enough. They felt like they had enough to, you know, sort of determine that there wasn't community spread and so that people should come back to school. And I think I communicated with the head. I was like, listen, or with the head of my division. And I was like, listen, it just doesn't make sense for me to come in tomorrow. So because we already had a meeting on the books to reevaluate my accommodations. So I know we haven't had a chance to meet, but I don't think it makes sense for me to come in. And then the faculty, we arranged a number of, like, there was sort of this series of Zooms that occurred where we were just talking about what we were going to do and, like, you know, why, what the breakdown in communication was between the faculty and the administration, that they didn't understand that this would be the result of sending out that email, of making this decision without, because they had been hearing from individual teachers over, you know, the past, you know, 4 or 5 days about the concerns and about, you know, potentially waiting until all the tests had come back before returning to school. And they had just were sort of like, well, we heard what you had to say, and we just want to let you know that everything's, you know, it's okay, come back in. And so there was one grade where 4 of the teachers stayed home. They sicked out, essentially. But they maybe made the tactical error of telling the administration that that's what they were doing. One of them was basically called by 2 administrators, and she described it as harassed and bullied about why she was staying home and how people can't pick and choose when they come to work. And how they would give her this day, but, you know, that was sort of the end of it. And this is somebody who has been teaching at the school for about a decade, right? This is like a very well-respected person. And, you know, she said she has a health condition which isn't on the list of ones that need to be considered, but it would affect her in the event of like hospitalization. And they're like, well, we didn't know that. You didn't tell us about that. And which is like ironic considering what happened later, but, you know, essentially during the course of those Zooms, the faculty Zooms, you know, I had encouraged people to like explore ADA accommodations for different conditions. And later, or, you know, what some people had reached out to me to be like, you know, can you tell me more about that process and what it was like? And so basically after a few days, everybody was kind of back in school after this outbreak. And then I started hearing from colleagues that in the sort of the new round of, okay, let me go back a little bit. There were three faculty members who were teaching from home. I had a set of accommodations. Those are the only, that's sort of everybody I knew about. We all had, and everybody who had accommodations that I knew of had sort of this 6-week cycle at which their accommodations were going to be reviewed. And I heard that somebody who was at home, that they were told that they had to come back in, that they would no longer be allowed to teach from home. And the reason given wasn't because it was too expensive or that they couldn't afford the coverage. It was that it wasn't working. And that was a little bit crazy. That was a little bit out there to me because there's plenty of people, like a lot of the teachers are working, a lot of the students are at home, right? So teachers are offering a remote education. The school is accepting money for a remote education, but suddenly it's not working to have a teacher zoom into the classroom. And then, so I think that's illegal actually also. So I was very concerned about that and very upset about that. And at the same time, I heard that a colleague who was pregnant, who was like, in her first trimester, that she had asked to be allowed to teach remotely, and she was teaching older kids. So, half her kids are always remote at any given time anyway. And that she was basically told, no, you can, maybe we can find part-time remote work for you, but you have to be in the building. And that the school nurse had called her OBGYN basically to get details on her medical condition, which the staff at the OBGYN's office basically said, nobody else has done this, so that was really unsettling. So basically they backed off on forcing people to come back into the school, but they did say that they would be reducing the amount of money they would be paying those people who were staying at home. Which I also don't know how that played out. That was something that I just learned about like last week, and I haven't heard too much more about it. But overall, just like the general posture from the administration changed pretty noticeably, from, of course, we'll accommodate you, to, well, you can't expect us to let this go on forever. And also, so one of the things that has been like a constant source of kind of disenchantment and stress is just the extent to which the faculty feel that the administration isn't transparent about its motivations, and how that keeps coming into like the relationship between the administration and the faculty in terms of believing what they say, and also our frustration when they come to us saying like, we can't believe you don't trust us. Like, don't you think we have your best interests at heart? Which is like, for listeners at home, I'm miming my head exploding. So those are some of the major milestones in management labor relationships at our school over the past month or so. And I would say that the funniest thing to observe has been the way that the administration will announce a policy that's ostensibly for the teacher's benefit and then immediately back off from it once parents protest against it. So an example here is, they said that the middle school is all remote on Friday. So for families who have a middle schooler and a lower schooler, a lot of these families were taking off for their Hamptons houses or their vacation houses. I don't know if they're all in the Hamptons. We're taking off for their country houses, and they wanted to leave on Thursday night to get ahead of the traffic. So they would take their lower schoolers with them, and then the lower schoolers would be remote on Friday, like zooming into the classroom. So for one day a week, the teacher would have to be teaching to people in the classroom and people at home for no other reason than that their parents wanted an easier commute to their country house. So this was really frustrating to a lot of the teachers. And so they said, if you take your kid out of school, then they're going to be out of school, basically. If you take them out of school, then there's not going to be a remote option for them unless they're sick or quarantining. And that lasted for like approximately 3 weeks. And then somebody complained, and now it's back to the other way. And the as far as we hear a lot of stuff from the students about sort of people breaking cohorts and people having birthday parties and people having, people participating in things and traveling. And, it's not egregious, but it's all the kind of stuff that basically we're just asking people not to do if you want the school to stay open. And the school just, they take a position that they can't police people's behavior, which is really funny. Because if you are familiar with the temporary shelter in the hotel situation, they are very comfortable with literally policing people's behavior and literally like having actual police, patrolling the streets to make sure that, these people are not offending anybody by like existing on the Upper West Side. So that was really, you know, another high point of the administration's communication strategy. So I think that the faculty kind of reached a point where they were, more people were comfortable sticking out than I expected. But some people, there's about two people who are quitting at the end of next week. Although I don't know if they're in the IT department. I don't know if the school knows about that. There's, you know, several people who are definitely not, or who expressed their intention of not coming back after next year. And, you know, so the morale is low. And the teacher who got sick is still at home. You know, she got sick about, you know, a month ago and maybe 5 weeks ago. I can't remember exactly, but she's still really tired. She's, you know, she has a lot of fatigue, you know, a lot of the stuff that we're hearing about with sort of the post-viral fatigue is happening for her. And she doesn't want to come back in because she doesn't feel physically up to it and she doesn't feel safe. And, you know, I've heard that she feels the school is pressuring her to come back. So that's all happening. And on the other end of things, you know, one of the COVID cases was the child of a teacher who attends the school, and that teacher had hosted a birthday party for multiple classes. It was outdoors, but it was still like, you know, a party where people ate and drank and were mixing outside of their cohorts, which, you know, which the administration had asked people not to do. So it's like there are teachers who are taking it seriously, and I guess there's, you know, a teacher who doesn't, right? And I don't know, I was just really surprised and shocked when I heard that. But, you know, I don't know what led to her making that decision. But I don't want to make it sound like the teachers are unanimously being saints and the parents are unanimously being jerks, because that's obviously not the reality. Where was I? Yeah, I guess trying to think about how it felt was just not good. You know, really upsetting, and also just really trying to think about what the right thing to do was, in terms of feeling like I was protected more so than other teachers. So I didn't want to ask other people to do something that they might have consequences for that I would not. But once teachers were ready to go, like, you know, I was glad that I was also home that day, right? I was glad that I was also not in school with them. And the parents did not figure out why teachers were not in school that day. Because like the like Rubicon of teacher protest is like letting the parents know that anything is wrong. Oh my God, this was insane. Oh. I love New York. It's never gonna stop, so I might as well just keep talking. The day after a bunch of teachers did not come in, the PA, as a gesture of gratitude, passed out thank you notes. And, you know, they weren't individually addressed. They like weren't individually signed. They were just like, thank you for everything you do. And we're like, the teachers, you should have seen the teachers' faces when like we got these. We were just like, what is this? Like, what is this? So anyway, that was also a moment of levity in an otherwise pretty stressful time.
So I know in past interviews you've talked about like organizing teacher solidarity, that kind of thing. So at this point where morale is pretty low, have there been any kind of like developments like other than that towards more teacher solidarity?
I think there have been. There's currently after the last kind of really really low moment. There was a group of teachers who reached, or the administration said that, I mean, and this is, I don't even know if this is like solidarity or not, but the administration was like, we want to form a committee, gotta have a committee about, you know, teacher and faculty concerns. So like there is now more of, there's definitely more interdivisional communication about different concerns. But I feel as though we're going to have to like get things going again. I feel like if they decide to stay open into the public school closure, I think that's like the next battleground or the next pressure point for our relationships. There are some schools that have said that they're closing after Thanksgiving, and our school has not committed to that, but it would be insane to stay open. Like, it's insane to stay open now, but it would be insane to stay open after Thanksgiving. So, you know, I guess I don't know what's happening with other teachers. I know that, like, teachers in my division have been communicating pretty regularly, but not to the extent that we were previously, where we were, like, you know, we had like weekly Zooms. We were like basically prior to faculty meetings where we were like going to go in and be like, with like where we would talk about what we were going to say and how we were going to say it and what we were looking for and what our main concerns were. Because I think that right now, like, we don't know. Like our main position has been like, we want to stay open, but we want things that will keep us safe. And now I feel like the position is we do not want to stay open. So I think we haven't, like, everybody's kind of like coming to that in their own time. Because honestly, we all hate remote teaching. Like, we hate it. So everybody's kind of like move in a different Kubler-Ross stage right now. And once we all finally get to acceptance, I feel like that's when we're going to be back at the table, like talking to the administration about what we need. But I feel like I have more people to talk to in the other divisions now, and I know that my other colleagues in our elementary division feel that way as well. I have more people to talk to, and I kind of like know who to talk to if I want to get like a lot of people on the same page very quickly. So that's helpful, I think.
If you can think back to how you were feeling in the last interview, like 3 days before your school opened, and how you're feeling now, like how would you describe if there's any difference in like mood, stamina, hope? I don't know, like how are you feeling, like if you can describe like how you felt then as compared to like how you are now at this point in the semester?
I mean, honestly, in some ways, there's a real rhyme between then and now, because then I couldn't believe we were opening, and now I can't believe we're still open. So that thread of disbelief is really consistent. And I think that prior to the reopening, I felt that I just felt like we weren't ready. I felt like we didn't have what we needed. And now I feel as though we have more of what we need. But like we had, because when we reopened, you know, they didn't have the plexi barriers for us. They didn't have a way to open the windows in half the rooms. They didn't have enough like K95s. They weren't like letting people know where to find them or how to do it. We didn't have outdoor learning space, which we have now. We didn't have enough teaching fellows to cover the periods that needed to be covered. So we have those things. We have those things now. I think that with the advent of like the colder weather and not being able to teach outside as much, I feel like those things are kind of like, you know, drifting away from us a little bit. So it, in some ways, it's a return to feeling more of the uncertainty and frustration that preceded the reopening. The benefit of having had this past 11 weeks, like I do feel like I know the students. I do feel like the students have had time to make connections with each other and with their friends. And I feel like, you know, in some ways, I just feel like, you know, we did what we could, right? Like we came in, we kept the building open. And I think that if we go to distance now, we'll be in a better position than we would have been if we'd started the year remotely. I guess that's another difference, because imagining starting the year remote was challenging. I guess it's just really, I'm in the same position of wondering, of thinking like, you know, the administration really makes decisions based on parent input, and concern over tuitions and with withdrawal and this and that. And that's kind of, they're kind of locked in a game of chicken with the other independent schools over who's going to close first. So there's also that feeling of like, but I have less expectation of being taken care of by the school now. So like, I think that's in some ways a more like stable, it's like I've reached some like a kind of a plateau where I don't, I have a clear idea of how decisions are made at the school. And so therefore I have a clear idea of what to expect. But I don't, I think that their decision is mostly going to be made around financial considerations and parent opinion. So and previously I thought that they would be a little bit more, but I think that they are sensitive to how faculty communications and faculty sentiment and opinion can affect the other things that they actually care about. So, yeah, six of one, half a dozen of the other. What was the question?
Like, how are you feeling now compared to the beginning of the semester?
I'm also just tired. Yeah, I would say that I'm really fucking tired. I went back on medication for ADD because my symptoms were just like out of control, despite the fact that it really like boosts my anxiety. And so that's been an exciting adventure. I've been really miserable for the past like 2 or 3 weeks. And so I stopped eventually, like at the beginning of this week, I just stopped taking the stimulant medication because I was like, I can't continue to feel like this. So just tired, lonely, sad. And just, you know, I think this, the like sort of the feeling of like not having, working so hard and feeling so unsuccessful is like really, it's really a drain, right? It really sucks. And that was one of the complaints that I personally had with the school's messaging to us at the beginning of the year was, you know, about 2 weeks in, the faculty kind of short-circuited a staff meeting to talk about things we observed that were making us feel really unsafe and also things that were making us feel concerned that we weren't adequately serving the kids, like in terms of the length of the instructional day, how they were dealing with the restrictions on their behavior and the restrictions on their movement. And the administration kind of took this tone with us about how we were just being too hard on ourselves and how we needed to, be less perfectionistic. And it was just one of many instances that were, really patronizing and also really insensitive to the difference between what an administrator's job right now is and what a teacher's job is. Because your head of school was in classrooms for a while, and our division head, I think, was in classrooms for a while, but you know, if you're a high level administrator, you probably have not been in the classroom in a while. And, the feeling of being told like, you know, don't worry about it is, really not a good one. Don't worry. It's kind of like the, don't worry about your health. Don't worry about how your students are doing. you know, just keep putting on a happy face for the parents and, you know, everything will be fine. The kids are resilient. The kids are okay. So that was frustrating. There's also just been a lot of like, you know, all these little kind of like flare-ups and brush fires over time and space and who gets to use what when and kind of like, what can we do that we couldn't do before and who gets priority. And, you know, those things are mostly pretty contained, but they're definitely just kind of like this thing that, you know, like over the course of a normal school year, those things are almost entertaining, right? It's like, you know, it's like a little skirmish, right? Like which grade is going to get priority in the lunch line and like who's going to get like the recess slot that they want. But now it feels really, really urgent. Like people are like, if I have to cover one more lunch period, I'm going to lose it. So there's like a real level of intensity that that was not there previously. And that's like, that's kind of draining, right? And also, you know, a couple of the people I work with, a lot of people are really unhappy. Some people are unhappy in kind of like a deeper way, I think, than others. Like they're feeling like they might change their profession or they're feeling like they might leave the country. We haven't even talked about how the election overlaid on all of this. Yeah, so there's just kind of like, and there's, I mean, on top of everything else, like there's personal loss, right? There's people who are sick, people who are dying. Our division head's husband is seriously ill. Like, you know, my grandmother died in October. You know, there's just like, you know, like there's just so much stuff going on all the time that people are already kind of at a lower ebb than they otherwise would be. Yeah. So I guess that's how I'm feeling. And I really feel bad. I really feel badly for the counseling staff at my school because they're really trying. But, you know, again, it's like watching people just throw themselves into like, you know, an enormous clockwork machine. They're like, self-care, like they're like flinging themselves in like self-care. And then like, there's like systemic problems. And it's like, you can't, what are you expected to do? Like, so we have two psychologists and a counselor. And, you know, they're really doing their best, but they're really containing a lot of faculty unhappiness right now.
I just want to say I'm so sorry for your loss. And we don't have to talk about it if you don't want to, but I like, this is something in our area of inquiry for all people is how they're dealing with grief, because I think everyone is dealing with some sort of grief in some sort of way. And like, you're dealing with like a very, like a hard death of a family member. And a lot of people are doing that as well. But you also talked about like levels of like acceptance or like going through stages, like with accepting that, you know, you might want to close the school down. So I want to ask if you're comfortable talking about it, like how you've been processing that grief, if at all, or like if you had time, what that's been like for you the past few months.
Yeah. Well, first of all, my grandmother was really amazing. And I loved her a lot, and it was not expected. You know, she was 85. So, you know, she was all very vibrant. She was like, we talked to her quite a bit, and, so I think that one of the things about losing a grandparent when you're like in your mid thirties is like, people are like, oh, like, well, it was time. And it's like, it just doesn't feel like that. But I don't know what to say that doesn't sound like, well, other people's grandmothers weren't as good as my grandmother. But, you know, she was, you know, she and my grandfather, my grandfather is still living. She and my grandfather were really the center of like my dad, they're on my dad's side, like so the center of family life. And so finding out that she, you know, she had a heart attack in the middle of the night, and then she lasted like into the morning of the next day. So, you know, I found out about it from my dad, you know, he called and he was like, Grandma's in the hospital. And I was like, oh, is she going to be okay? And he was like, no, you know, she's not. So they live in Rochester, my dad is in the city. I'm trying to remember, there was some kind of timing where I had been at home. Like I was sick a number of days in that month, and I couldn't pass the screening, I guess is another way to put it. So I had actually been at home and I had had a recent test. And so I basically like swathed up in like face mask, KN95, like the whole shebang, got on Metro North and wound up and met my dad at his girlfriend's place. And my brother drove up from Philadelphia and met us there. And so we were actually able to go to Rochester. We got an Airbnb. And so it was, the whole process was very strange because, you know, usually like when we go to Rochester, like my dad's the oldest of nine, like we meet at like a family, like we meet at, you know, one of his sister's places. You know, everybody gets together. So obviously none of that was happening. And it was also a question of like, who would stay with my grandfather, right? Because people were coming in from all over the place and my grandfather's 93 and like, you know, people wanted to share it, but also people were really worried about his health and they were concerned that he was going to, that he would be sick. Also, like my dad, you know, my dad's siblings, they're all, you know, they're all of a certain age and many of them have health conditions. And so there's like this whole, you know, all of these at-risk people, half of whom don't believe that the coronavirus is serious, you know, kind of like making these decisions about where to go, when to eat, what to do. And I was mostly just worried about supporting my dad. And my sister decided to fly up with her daughter who's still nursing. So we were all able to be together and that was pretty nice, but it also felt like a little risky. And so I think it was just like not always having to be worried about coronavirus at the same time that we were trying to balance these other concerns about supporting family members, supporting my dad, remembering my grandmother, like processing what was happening. It's still very hard to believe. She really hated Trump. I was really sad when on Saturday that I couldn't share that like moment with her. I was talking to my dad every day anyway, but like, you know, I would love to be able to spend more time with him. You know, I'd love to be able to be, but I can't, I'm working, right? I'm at the school and my dad is in like, you know, four different high risk groups. And so just needing to be, and he doesn't really care so much, but just needing to be kind of cautious and careful about how I go up and support him. Or how I see him and what we can do to support him is really tough. And you know, then it really makes me think about my grandfather. And so I think that I've also been, you know, thinking about and worrying about, you know, what the last years of his life are going to be like. People say the weirdest shit when people die. Like, I'm sure you know this, but like, you know, who fucking said this? God, it was somebody, it really pissed me off. And she was like, I can tell, you know, I'm a psychic and I can tell that your grandfather's only hanging on to see, make sure that everybody's okay. And then he's going to go join Beverly. And it's like, just shut up. Just don't say shit like that. But you know, being worried that he's only going to live for like another year or 2 years or 3 years, you know, if we're lucky, and thinking about how much of that time, you know, he might be alone, is challenging. So I guess I just feel sad. I feel sad that I can't be with my family in the same way that I usually would. And at the same time, you know, I think that everybody's thinking about what they should be, what they can be grateful for. And, you know, I'm glad that I got to know her for so long, you know, like, you know, and that she was, you know, a real presence in my life for as long as she was. So that's a real blessing. And it's also the attitude my dad is taking. He's like, I'm basically the only person in my age group that I know who had two parents as long as I did. But it doesn't really make it better. You know, it doesn't really make it better. So yeah, and I think that we're all kind of like reaching that stage in pandemic where maybe we're not all, I'm reaching that stage in pandemic where, you know, like shifting over everything that you thought would be a, that would be more temporary than it's turning out to be, right? And kind of like trying to find ways to sustain abnormal levels of effort in different areas of your life, like tolerating uncertainty, tolerating loneliness, tolerating risk and sadness, and while still remaining like attuned to the reality of needing to protect yourself and needing to make good decisions. Like today, I just got really overwhelmed. I was just thinking about like, you know, I was just thinking about like, you know, how many more people are going to die and how like all those people are alive right now. Like they're all alive. They're real people. They're walking around and like, you know, then walking by restaurants and like, you know, and not blaming everything on the restaurants, of course, but like the fact that indoor dining is open, right? The fact that we haven't had a shutdown, the fact that we didn't have, you know, any kind of like financial support for people to be able to stay home. And just thinking about like the individual people right now who don't know that they're going to die, but they're going to, you know, that's the kind of stuff that like you can't stay in it, but like it just kind of breaks through at different moments and becomes pretty overwhelming.
Sorry. So sorry. Okay. Yeah, I feel like I want to touch a little bit more on the instability aspect and tolerating that. Like not only has your like kind of teaching situation been really changeable, but also this kind of, you know, de Blasio announcement, schools might shut down, all of that. Like how's that been?
I do something that's really bad for myself, which I read an online forum called New York City Moms. And it has, it's the successor to a previous, you know, chaotic evil site called Urban Baby. And I've really got to stop doing it because it's like it's like my projection of like what the worst parents at our school like think like. But I'm frustrated because I don't, you know, schools obviously shouldn't be shut down before indoor dining, but indoor dining should have been shut down like, you know, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, like never reopened. So to watch like the talking points evolve out of like that kind of like little micro slice of like New York, you know, upscale kind of status climber or status seeker, like to watch like people kind of like coalesce around these different positions of like, you know, oh, well, they should shut this down first. It's like, well, the cat's out of the bag. Like, everything needs to shut down now. I think that I'm unhealthily seeking out people whose opinions frustrate and sadden me. And I don't really know why. Maybe it's because, like, the like, inchoate rage is the only, like, thing that's propelling me through the day. So that's, The thing that drives me insane most of all is just like between Cuomo and de Blasio, like, and President Trump, like, you know, there's this male ego, no offense, male ego situation where like it's all about like political gain. It's all about like political gain and consolidating power bases. And like, none of it is about how can we keep people safe. And like, none of it is about what's the best decision for, you know, the people who are most at risk from COVID. It's all about like, which industries can we keep alive? Who's going to vote for us? Where are my power blocks? Like, you know, and you know, for de Blasio and Cuomo to continue their pissing match into this pandemic, like it's obscene. It's completely watching it play out through the lens of the homelessness crisis and through the shelter situation, it has also really deepened my resentment and deepened my frustration, and my like commitment to doing whatever I can to make sure that there is a different political situation, because you know they just don't care. They just don't care, and they're not listening to people who do care. So that has been a struggle. And feeling like, I mean, we have the uncertainty that we can't do anything about. Like, we never know when the next pandemic is going to emerge, right? We never know, like, but we, like, the uncertainty that's caused by people not being cooperative, not being collaborative, not being like science-based, not like that, that uncertainty is difficult to tolerate because it feels unnecessary. And, you know, I know that I should like try to move towards thinking of that as being like just also a natural outcome of like human nature and economics or whatever, but I still take it really personally. Yeah. So that's where the deep kind of like frustration and uncertainty comes from. And it just also seems incredible to me that like the number of people who can't pay rent in this city, right? The number of people who, you know, can't predict whether, like, the amount of food insecurity, the amount of housing insecurity, like, the fact that there's not any plan, like, all we're hearing about is cutbacks and austerity, and, like, all we're, like, is, that provides a type of deep uncertainty for me as well about, like, what's going to happen to this city if, you know, if there's not a priority towards making life more stable for the vast majority of people who live here. And then on top of that is the election uncertainty, right? Which is again, like people, you know, fucking Mitch McConnell, like refusing to accept the political situation in order to drum up support for, in order to potentially gain some kind of margin in like the Georgia races. Like this is fucking insane. And again, it feels personal, it feels callous, it feels avoidable and unnecessary. And so those are the uncertainties that are the hardest to accept at this moment.
I saw in your last interview, you talked a lot about like, you know, your desire to kind of teach with like a social justice lens, especially in like the wake of George Floyd's murder and, you know, all the stuff that you just mentioned. And I was wondering like how the actual teaching has been and like how the kids have been and like if you've been able to kind of like teach like to your values during this time still.
Yeah, I would say that the between the like nearby shelter and the election, there were a lot more avenues into teaching this sort of things with the sort of attitude that I want to and that I like to do, and that I feel is necessary. And actually, the way that it's come out most is that I've been using. I decided at the beginning of the year that given that we were likely going to go remote at some point, that I wanted to have an ongoing long-term project that kids could do whether they were in school or at home. So I started introducing them to StoryCorps and to, there's a YouTube channel called Hi Ho Kids, and they have a kids meet, which is where like kids of different ages like interview people with different life experiences. And so we started watching those, or we started watching those in order to, and talking about different types of questions that you can ask people. And it's modified from fourth down to second. First grade, I'm not doing it with. It's modified from fourth down to second to like what the kids are expected to like eventually produce if they feel like it, because I have a really strong no homework stance. So, you know, the interviews that we've been watching have offered a lot of opportunities for really rich conversations, and also talking about why this type of interview is like a building block of history and how it provides like many different perspectives that otherwise are not necessarily preserved. So that has been really, you know, talking more about the kind of history making aspect of it with fourth grade has been interesting. Talking about it from the talking about it from the primary source perspective in the third grade, and then in the second grade, just talking about it from the perspective of personal narrative, because a lot of them, one of the big writing arcs in that grade is writing a personal narrative. And then being able to watch, like we watched, you know, a bunch of the ones that were about voting rights, the ones that were about people working as poll workers, the ones that were about the pandemic, right? Being able, hearing people's stories of working in the pandemic and sort of just hearing voices that they don't usually hear, right? And thinking about what, you know, what's going on, you know, like how you can live your whole life and not necessarily know about people who have different experiences than you. And so those moments have been really, really positive. And I think really engaging for the students, which is nice. And then they're also practicing on each other. So it's been really, it's been interesting to see them, you know, share a little bit more about, you know, things in their life that they otherwise might not. You know, I think that trying to focus on, I mean, questions that are not like, what's your favorite color and like, what's your favorite food, and asking them to share more stories about times that were difficult or times that they were in conflict with other people in their family. Like they're definitely sharing more with their classmates than they previously had. Are their classmates listening? Don't know. We're working on that next. But I think that just feeling how good it feels to be heard and understood by somebody else, even if they don't necessarily agree with you, is really good for them. And listening, especially with the election, you know, being able to listen to a point of view that they know their parents don't hold, and like just to perceive it without necessarily having to push back against it and say, I agree with that, I don't agree with that, I think is a valuable skill for them. I've also been able to support some of the teachers in finding like different online resources and different materials to use that are like, that have more diversity in them than we typically have used in the past. More teachers are interested in it now, which is really good. And then the school has been doing diversity and inclusion workshops with two consultants who I think are really excellent, but it's frustrating to be in the workshops and then to try to like ask for policy changes or try to like implement policy changes and hear like, you know, it's not the time. It's, you know, we have to be incremental. We have to be patient, or just to be shut down, which is always a salutary experience. So I'm in the position of like being grateful for getting to do this work with these trained people, while being frustrated at the administration that is giving me the same opportunity. We're having a little bit of a situation with that right now where there's the National Association of Independent Schools runs a conference every year called the People of Color Conference, which is also, I guess, I'm not sure if this is for legal reasons, but it's also open to white people. And so this year the school was like, you know, anybody who wants to go, like any educator of color who wants to go can go. And then, you know, this is a great year for white people to go because it's like by Zoom, it's like remote. So if like you feel like your presence is disrupting things, you can like, you know, pull back or whatever. And one of my colleagues, the Damara, who's in the room with me, she's biracial Black and white Ashkenazi Jewish. And she was like, this would be, I think you should go. I think this would be great. And I was like, I don't know. And she was like, no. Like, I want to do it. You know, it would be good to have a group of people from our school who will do it. So I asked to go and my sister asked to go and we got approved. And then two of the teaching fellows who are people of color asked to go and they got rejected. we found out about this today. And so, my sister was like, she sent an email to her division head and she was like, listen, if it's a money thing, like, I don't want to go, like, you can give my spot to somebody else. And the division head came down to talk to her in the library. So I was there and then Damara was in the corner, like hearing the whole thing. Damara was the one who had encouraged the teaching fellows to apply to go. And the division head said, you know, it's not a money thing. So like you going won't prevent other people from going. Their request wasn't granted for totally different reasons. And so Rachel was like, well, I guess I'm just, you know, it's hard for me to understand like what the reasons are. And she said, well, they've only been working with the school in some cases for just a matter of weeks. So, and Rachel was like, yeah, but you know, I don't really see why that makes a difference. They're like, well, the nature of the job is just so temporary. And Rachel made the point, which I thought was good, which was that, you know, they're temporary, but like they're also integral to the success of the program this year. And like, this is supposed to be a really transformative like conference for people of color in independent schools who are often really usually oftentimes are kind of like alone or, you know, scattered among primarily white institutions. And Rachel's like, you know, so they're really talented, and not that that should matter, but like, you know, if we want to attract and retain faculty of color, which is one of our like institutional goals, like, you know, this is a good way to do it, to support people's professional development. And the division head was like, well, I'll take this back to the committee, but, you know, we really thought about it. It wasn't like we just said no off the cuff. Meanwhile, I had already heard that like they did say, like if they thought about it, they didn't explain their thinking at all to the people whom they rejected. So we're, you know, my colleague, like Damara was like, I'm, you know, she's on the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Social Justice Committee. And she was like, I think I need to resign because if they're not, they're just not doing anything, you know, like if this is what happens when we ask them to take substantive steps, I'm not going to sit there and just constantly voice my opinion only to be like rejected, which I think is completely fair. So anyway, that's like an instance of something that happens at our school. And, you know, sort of like the, what happens when you have equity initiatives that are run entirely by white people is always, you know, has predictable outcomes. And like, of course, you know, they hired this really great consulting firm, but like they hired them, right? They're the employers of this consulting firm. So there's always a question of like, what can you expect people to do? Well, you know, you can't expect a consulting firm to fix an institution if the administration doesn't want it to be fixed. So anyway, that's something that happened today. It's really nice to just be able to complain about my workday and to somebody who can't say that they're ready to talk about something else. But if you are, please let me know.
You can keep talking about it if you want.
I mean, if you have follow-up questions, I'll answer them, but that's basically the shape of what happened.
Okay. I just wanted to, I mean, give you like an opportunity to talk more about the hotel situation, because you've, you know, mentioned it throughout this interview. So, you know, I don't know the exact contours of what's going on. But if there are ways that it like has impacted like the school and your place in it and the culture and everything, like I'd definitely be interested in hearing more about that.
Sure. So, you know, basically the shelter has, or the temporary shelter at the Lucerne has been operational up to this present date. And actually there's a decision that's going to affect the future of it that's going to happen on the 16th. So it's sort of continued, and the West Side Community Organization has also continued to, I think they sued the city to get it moved, to like force the city to relocate the men living at the shelter to the financial district, or just kind of like anywhere else. Basically the city caved and said, okay, sure, we'll do it. And then they got sued in their turn by the Legal Aid Society, and because it's like complete bullshit. But the city was like, okay, we're moving them down to the financial district. And the financial district NIMBYs immediately were like, well, you know, the West Side Community Organization managed to get it moved, so we can probably do the same thing. So they have a lawsuit to stop the move. And that lawsuit is going to be decided on the 16th. And so we're kind of anxiously watching that situation. You know, there was a story that came out recently about, you know, somebody basically bribing shelter residents with food and money if they would sign a piece of paper saying that they wanted to be moved. So that was disappointing. And I kind of like, you know, there's always kind of like this sick part of me that wants to know who it was, you know, and if it was somebody at my school. There are parents who are supporters of the West Side Community Organization including, you know, there's one like well-connected family who I think are probably the most vocal about it. And then there are people who are trying to do their best to kind of like keep, or not keep the shelter, but like make sure that like the situation is as good as possible and to support the shelter residents in whatever way they choose to be supported, through this Open Hearts Initiative organization, which has been operating, kind of, food drives, clothing drives, accompaniment programs for people going to doctor's appointments, voter registration, you know, kind of the gamut, and clergy support for people who want it, who are in the shelters or in the shelter. So it's been good to be involved with the Open Hearts Initiative organization, but it's also been really good because I feel like they are taking their lead from shelter residents. And so I feel like I've also become more informed about like different like policy actions to support that actually will support people experiencing homelessness. One of the, this, I can't remember his last name, but his first name is Shams, and he sometimes goes by the Homeless Hero, he zoomed in to talk with our middle schoolers during a week of action thing that one of my colleagues in the middle school planned. And he's been really, like vocal and helpful about kind of educating people about what does and doesn't work, what does and doesn't help. Like specifically also around like the voucher system and the personal allowance and kind of like these different aspects that are like have make a huge impact on people's day-to-day lives, but are often like not considered in the discussions that people have around how to support people who have housing insecurity. But overall, like one thing that I would like to see is kind of a recognition from members of the community that like they were wrong, like nothing bad happened, right? Like any kind of like acknowledgement like that, I think would be really instructive and helpful, just in preventing this sort of thing from happening in the future, and also just like improving the level of you know, awareness and education around stuff like this. So the men are still resident at Lucerne. They may wind up being moved, or the city may try to move them, on November 16th, or pending the November 16th decision. It seems like there's a permanent shelter facility that's being built in the financial district, although it seems like, you know, obviously people are trying to sue to stop that, but you know, the city is completely within its rights. So all they need to do is actually have a spine for once in their lives. So that's kind of the situation. There's also a life skills program that's happening, but I'm a little weirded out by it. So I don't know if I'm going to be involved in that. But it's another thing that's going on, from the Open Hearts Initiative and Project Renewal, which is the clinic that runs the shelter or the shelter operator. We've used narratives, or I've used narratives from people who have experienced homelessness or are currently experiencing it with my students, and it has brought up conversations about homelessness on the Upper West Side, and also, you know, specifically the Lucerne, because a lot of our kids know roughly about the situation, and it's interesting to be able to talk to them about, and I think helpful, I hope helpful, to be able to talk to them about mental illness and drug use and like the different factors that are leading to what they're noticing. Right, which is, you know, homeless, like the encampments and also like the shelter arguments and things like that. Yeah. There's a really annoying thing about my school, or not annoying, I guess I've recently become more irritated by it. Our big pitch to parents oftentimes is that a K-8 school like keeps kids younger longer. And sometimes I feel like that's interpreted as, you know, having an excuse not to engage with students about difficult issues. But I've been pleasantly surprised that there hasn't been pushback from parents this year about the range of topics that we're covering. I double and triple check everything to make sure that it's all completely defensible on like educational, moral, like institutional grounds, but you always expect like, or I expected more pushback than I have received.
All right, we're coming up on like an hour 15. So I feel like I've asked most of the things that I've been curious about, but I wanted to also let you, like if there's something I didn't ask about that you want to talk about or something you want to go back to, if there's anything like that you think needs to be said.
I think that, I guess I just wanted to say that there's a real weird cognitive dissonance around teaching students right now and like knowing about what's happening all around the country with coronavirus deaths. It feels a little bit like climate change, but like, you know, condensed and speeded up, like talking about like, you know, like they don't know. And maybe, you know, it's probably appropriate that they don't know at the age that they are, but it still continues to be very strange to, you know, be telling kids all the time, like, you know, make sure you're giving each other enough room and like pull up your mask and do this without like kind of like, you know, talking about some of the larger context, right? Talking about some of the larger numbers. I think that is increasingly weird to me. I think it's part of the mental energy of teaching this year is managing kind of that dissonance. That's it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Sure.
For doing this interview. I really appreciated our conversation.
I appreciated having the opportunity, and thank you for being a patient listener.